The American space program, from the Mercury 7 to Apollo 11 to the Voyagers and Hubble, is one of our nation's proudest success stories. But it didn't just start from scratch after the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. Spacemen, the latest episode of the PBS American Experience series, tells the story of the U.S. Air Force's first projects using balloons to lift humans higher into the stratosphere than ever before and even scratch the surface of outer space. It premieres tonight at 9 on PBS Station. And joining us now is writer-director and co-producer Amanda Pollack. And it is a great pleasure to also welcome one of the men who first saw outer space with his own eyes from 100,000 feet, U.S. Air Force Colonel Joseph Kittinger. Amanda, Colonel Kittinger, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I didn't know any of this. This is a total surprise to me. Was it a surprise to you, Amanda, when you first heard about it?
Yes, it absolutely was. This was a story that I knew nothing about before I began researching it. And
what got you started?
Well, I picked up a book by a guy named Craig Ryan called The Pre-Astronauts, and I began reading and became fascinated by this story that no one had heard of. You know, the space program is something that we kind of take for granted today, and we all know. But looking back at what these guys were doing in the 1940s and 50s and even earlier in order to sort of uncover this uncharted territory really blew me away, and I just started diving deeper into the story.
Colonel Kittinger, weren't you a test pilot? How did you get involved with the Air Force balloon projects?
Well, I was a test pilot, and I was at Holloman Air Force Base, and one day we got a notice that Dr. Stapp was looking for a volunteer for a new program he was starting. And I volunteered for it and went over and had an interview with Dr. Stapp. And he was a visionary. He was a man who, back in the early 50s, knew we were going to go into space, and he knew that there were certain elements of information that we needed to prepare us for a space program. And one of these was, we had never really done any research if a man could survive a prolonged period of weightlessness, which is what we're going to end up in orbit around the Earth. So he started this program to see if man could really adapt to zero gravity. And I was a test pilot on it, and I made about over 1,000 runs with various people in the back seat of the aircraft and recording their response to weightlessness. And that was really the first start to find out if man could, in fact, adapt to a zero-gravity situation. And it was because of the genius of Dr. Stapp that we started back in 1955, really, to look at these very intricate challenges that were facing us to go into space.
Tell us a bit about Dr. John Paul Stapp, Amanda. He was in aviation medicine?
Yeah, he was a doctor, and he was in the Army, and he was looking around in the late 40s and then into the early 50s, and he was seeing what was happening with aviation technology. He was seeing rocket technology had really advanced after World War II, and he was watching what was happening with planes. And as a medical doctor, he was thinking to himself, well, what is going to happen to the human body as human beings go faster and higher up into the atmosphere? And, you know, at that time, no one was really thinking about space. There were a few people thinking about it as rockets were being developed, but it was not really in the public consciousness. And Stapp was seeing what was happening with technology and aviation, and he was thinking to himself, we are going to be going into space, and we need to prepare for this moment. We need to make sure that humans are going to be safe in this environment.
And so he's a medical doctor and a physicist.
Yeah, he was a physicist as well.
And didn't he develop a rocket-powered sled for his experiments? Used himself as the test subject?
Yes, and it's quite, I mean, there's famous footage, which is just unbelievable to watch, because he develops something called a rocket sled, which is this contraption that does not look very high tech, but he uses it to basically test the impact of G-force on the human body. And he actually used himself as the test subject, and he powered through at up to 600 miles per hour and then came to a very abrupt stop using a hydraulic brake. And what he was trying to understand is what would happen to the human body if it had to come to a stop at this kind of speed.
Didn't they think that that was actually impossible for the body to withstand?
Yes, yes, absolutely. At the time, I think it was 18 Gs was kind of the conventional wisdom as to what the human body could withstand, and he pushed it over double that.
Colonel Kittinger, you say some people referred to Dr. Stapp as a mad scientist. Was he eccentric?
No, and I never heard anybody call him a mad scientist. He was a brilliant person, and all of us in the business recognize him for his brilliance and has been a visionary. He was a very dedicated person. He was a wonderful man to work for because he was very considerate of the people that were going to be doing the test, and he never asked anybody to do anything he didn't do first himself. He was just a remarkable man.
And then a major figure in this story is Dr. David Simons.
Well, Simons was he was just a project officer for the Man-I program.
That's what they call this, the Man-High program.
This was the next program that Dr. Stapp monitored and sponsored. And here was the thing. Dr. Stapp knew we went into space that we were going to be in a very small, confined cockpit. So, and also we had not developed the life support systems, the communications, the physiological monitoring, the selection process. All of these things had never been addressed to put a man into a space for an astronaut. So Stapp came up with this program, and there wasn't any airplane to go up or rocket, so we used a balloon. And the capsule was 3 feet across and 7 feet high, and I made the first flight on the program up to 98,000 feet. And all of these lessons, there were three flights made on this program, and all of the lessons that we learned were later used by NASA when they started developing the Mercury capsule. So what Dr. Stapp did, he shortened the time it took NASA to accomplish the Mercury program. That was the brilliance of this man. He anticipated what was needed to put the man into the system.
Amanda, why was funding always so difficult to obtain? Didn't Otto Winsen, the balloon manufacturer who made the balloons that took men up in these man-high flights, underwrite many of the costs?
Yeah, he himself did have to. He and his wife had to add additional funding into the projects. You know, I think it goes back to the idea that the idea of going into space at this moment in time was not something that the military was really focusing their energy on at all. And so these guys, Stapp was really, as Colonel Kittinger said, he was really a visionary, and he was doing this work kind of ahead of his times, and the military just wasn't really supporting him.
What were the circumstances of your first ascent in Man-High 1?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
What were the circumstances of your first ascent in Man-High 1, and when was it?
Well, it was in June of 1957, and I took off from South St. Paul, Minnesota.
Why Minnesota? And, why was Minnesota chosen for so many of these launches?
Well, that's where the Winsen plant was.
Uh-huh.
And there wasn't, as Amanda said, you know, the funding was extremely difficult. Everybody was competing for the available funds, and space was not a priority at all. As a matter of fact, Stapp had very difficult time in getting financing for these programs, and some of it was funds that he transferred from other programs to accomplish the tasks. It was a real challenge because there was no support from the upper echelon within the Air Force, within the government, within the Department of Defense. There was no support for space programs. But Stapp saw the reason. And as you pointed out, Otto Winsen helped finance actually the last flight of the program because the funds had just run out.
Now, what was the view like from 96,000 feet? Did you see that
fantastic
half-blue, half-black division?
It was fantastic because I was really the first man to have an opportunity to fly at that altitude in a pressurized system. Aircraft had been up that high, but just a very short periods of time as they reached the top of the trajectories. But it was beautiful. You know, it was looking out through the window, I could see the different colors and the Earth 20 miles below. It was a fantastic experience to look at the skies, particularly overhead, because it was black overhead, completely black, And, of course, our whole life we're used to seeing the blue skies. So when you look up and you don't see any sun, it's an amazing event. And every astronaut that's ever been into space since then has remarked about that.
Those were the days before Mission Control, before NASA. How did you stay in contact with the ground, or did you?
Well, one of the problems I had on my program was that the radio broke as soon as I took off. But I had a Morse code. I could transmit Morse code and receive on the radio. So I communicated by tapping out my messages on Morse code, and then they would respond on the radio. I could hear them, but they could not hear me. So it was kind of a laborious process. I wasn't that good at Morse code, so it took me a while to transmit a message. But that was really one of the few problems that we had. And it was overcome by having a backup system.
Now, you were in a gondola below of what looks like a very flimsy balloon.
It was
like flimsy. A weather balloon.
Well, it's not a weather balloon. It's a stratospheric balloon made out of plastic material that was 2 million cubic foot displacement. Weather balloons are small, 4 or 5 foot across. But this was specifically designed to take a payload up above the Earth's atmosphere. And it was about almost 200 feet across once it reached ceiling altitude. If we'd had an aircraft that could have gotten that high to stay there for periods of time, we'd use an aircraft because it'd been a lot simpler than a balloon. But a balloon was really the only vehicle that could get you up that high for prolonged periods of time. And as a matter of fact, it's still being used for scientific purposes here some 6 years later.
Now, Amanda, was this all part of a soft space race with the Soviet Union?
Not yet. Not at that time.
Weren't they sending people up as well in some other countries?
They were doing some balloon research, but it wasn't really, the space race really just hadn't started at this point. We weren't thinking of putting a man in space at this moment in time, and it wasn't until Sputnik happened in 1957 that suddenly the American government and the military all decided that this was going to become a priority.
Although Dr. Simons, who was the pilot of Mannheim 2, got dubbed the first spaceman.
He did, yes.
Not you, Colonel Kittinger.
Well, Simons was the one that came up with the title, but I made the first flight. He made the second flight.
Now let's talk about your amazing one, 102,000-foot jump. Now, can you talk about the circumstances of that?
Once again, because of the genius of Dr. Stapp, he knew that when we went into space, a man would have to get out of the spacecraft. We had never had a man in space. We'd had altitude chambers, but we'd never had a man into space. That was the one objective. The second objective was to provide a means of escape from very high altitude. And those were the two objectives of the Excelsior program. And I made three jumps, and on the third jump, I jumped from 102,800 feet. I reached 614 miles an hour. I free fell for 4 minutes and 36 seconds, and we accomplished the objectives that we set out for. We proved that man could work in a space environment, and we also proved we could get a man back from high altitude. And by the way, the small drogue chute that we developed on the Excelsior program is still being used today. Every ejection seat in the world uses a small drogue chute to provide stabilization for the man that's in the seat. So what we did some 55 years ago is still being used today, which makes us all very happy. But once again, we accomplished some bits of information that needed to be defined by before we went into space. And by the way, as Amanda pointed out, Sputnik was the one that really stimulated our interest in space. And Yuri Gagarin, he was the first man into space in a spacecraft. And that was in 1961, wasn't it, Amanda, when Gagarin went up.
Yeah.
And that really stimulated us. Space race with the Russians, and it culminated with us walking on the moon some 8 years later. We went from the first space flight to walking in 8 years.
Now, just one other thing. You had to fall 80,000 feet before you finally pulled the ripcord. Were you afraid that you might pass out?
Oh, no. I had confidence in myself and my equipment and my team, and I was sure I wasn't going to pass out. I was there as a test pilot to gather information that we needed for this program. As I said, I'd made two other jumps, one from 76, one from 75,000. And those flights proved that I would be conscious during the flight. That was not any problem at all. The concern was how to achieve stabilization, because pilots, astronauts and high-altitude pilots are not skydivers. So we had to provide a means of escape that they could use without being a skydiver.
Amanda, you have some amazing footage here. So yeah. At least they filmed it all.
Yes. No, that was one of the best parts. As a filmmaker, these guys were doing scientific research, and so they were filming everything they were doing. And the footage is unbelievable. When I was listening to Colonel Kittinger describe his view from 100,000 feet, and there's actually film footage looking out the window of the gondola, and it's beautiful. So it really was a privilege to be able to work with all that material. It was amazing.
Spaceman will be broadcast tonight on PBS stations, and it's a part of the American Experience series. My great thanks to its writer-director and co-producer, Amanda Pollack, and also to the man who made so many of those jumps, Colonel Joseph Kittinger. It's been a real pleasure having both of you on our show.
Thank you very much.
9 o'clock
tonight.
9 o'clock.